Welcome to the Vital Masculinity Podcast. Welcome new listeners, welcome back regular listeners. This week, we have a treat for you. This is a little new for us. We will be reading a piece of fiction and looking at how it can assist us in understanding what it means to be a virtuous man. We will be reading a passage from The Lord of the Rings. For you fans out there, it's from the chapter where they are traveling through Moria. There will be plenty of examples to examine in which the characters display fortitude, as well as some other virtues as well. It was a lot of fun to record it, and I think you'll enjoy a change of pace. If I have anything to say about it, this will be the first of many episodes where we look at masculinity through the lens of great works of culture. Next week, if all goes according to plan, we will have another special treat for you. We are having our very first guest on the show. Scott Smith from the Catholic Nerds podcast will be joining us. He has written a book on the Lord of the Rings, as well as one called The Catholic Man Book. I know I'm looking forward to the discussion, so keep an eye out for that. That's enough announcements for now, though. Let's get the show rolling.
Today, we are going to talk about why becoming a better hobbit will make you a better man. This is the Vital Masculinity Podcast, trying a new intro for our one of our first interludes for the series, following the Cardinal Virtues series, which has been going on for the past 30 episodes. My name is Stephen Slur. I'm here with Brian Murphy, as always, and today we're going to talk about The Hobbit and Courage. Brian, how you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty well. Actually, this reminds me of something about being a hobbit, because in college, I had, with my indoor track team, they gave me the nickname Rudy, which is this Sean Astin, who played Rudy in the movie, also played Samwise in Lord of the Rings. So they also called me Samwise from time to time.
Well, that's pretty awesome. I don't have any nicknames like that, let alone ones that are related to Tolkien. So I'm a little bit jealous. But today we're going to be talking about just how, like in this instance, the Lord of the Rings can, and meditating on that, can make you a much more virtuous man. Brian, would you like to talk about kind of why we're talking about the Lord of the Rings on a podcast about masculinity and virtue?
Yeah, so this clip that we're going to play in a few minutes here, that's, I think when we think about fiction, we often think of, like, you know, it's made up, it's fake, it's not real, it's not really helpful. And I've come across people who say, I don't read fiction, I only read nonfiction, because nonfiction is the only thing that's going to be helpful to my life. But, I mean, the great thing about fiction, I think, is that, you know, certainly there's crappy fiction out there, but good fiction, it helps you to envision scenarios, situations, maybe different people's lives that you would not be able, that you know, it would be a challenge to think about on your own and just make it up. You can kind of look and see how these people respond to certain situations, and it helps you to kind of visualize and think about, well, what would I do in this situation?
In most books, for most authors, they are writing about what their idea of the ideal life would be, or in many cases, the virtuous life. And when you look at authors like Tolkien or Dostoevsky, who I think we've referenced before, and we'll be talking about Tolkien tonight, in particular, they're talking about the virtuous life, and a lot of the different virtues really come out in their writing. And when you look at the writing as compared to, say, the movies that you have with the three Lord of the Rings movies, yes, it's nice to have the movie. Don't get me wrong. I enjoy the movies. I think they're great. I really hope they don't make any remakes, because The Hobbit was not good. I did not like any of the new Hobbit movies. But movies are, in so many ways, they take your imagination out of it. So you're not trying, as you're reading, to actively envision a lot of these characters, a lot of the situations that they're in. And as I just mentioned, you're not trying to envision how they're living their ideal life or a virtuous life. So when you're reading, you can much more easily put yourself into situations where you can imagine living virtuously, or facing situations where you may need to make a just decision or a prudent decision, or you need to be courageous, like in the example that we're talking about now. So you can't really do that easily in film or in television because you're really just a passive actor there. When you're reading a book, you're actually, it's like having a conversation with the author. And while you're doing that in your mind, you're trying to come up with the entire backdrop and you're sketching out the characters and their motivations and all of these other things. So that extra effort helps you get over the hump to make it actually worthwhile in the pursuit of virtue to do this for at least good books.
One of the things that is also challenging in movies is to depict what is the character thinking about? What are they feeling? Like, that's something that the author can describe in a book, but when you watch a movie, you kind of just have to, you know, guess, or if the actor does a good job, but maybe it's a little easier to see, but you still don't really see what's going on in their head, what they're thinking about. And that's really one of the keys to, you know, recognizing, are they acting virtuously? Because as we talked about in the example of fortitude, just looking at the action, you can't tell if they're acting with fortitude or if they're just doing something that's courageous, but, you know, maybe they're not afraid of it. Maybe it's stupid or whatever the reason is. So I think that's a real important part to fiction, is when the author helps us to kind of enter into the mind of the character and see what they're struggling with internally as they go about the story.
And at the end of the day, fiction's just enjoyable, especially if it's written well. I mean, you guys could read a book that Brian and I would write about all these great ways to be courageous and why you should be courageous, and just a very stereotypical nonfiction book. Or heck, you know, we could even make it a boring, you know, dissertation if we really wanted to. But compared to the emotions that are invoked in, like, just this one scene in The Fellowship of the Ring, I mean, it doesn't compare. This one scene, and really this entire book and so many books, they're able to evoke these emotions that will drive you to have to confront a lot of questions. Like, what would I do in this situation? Why are these people acting in such a way? You know, and by doing so, you're really meditating on a way that you can become virtuous yourself in a fun way, as compared to reading it in a dissertation, which at least that's my cup of tea, but I'm kidding. It's not.
Yeah. So why don't I set the stage for this clip we're about to play, especially if you haven't read Lord of the Rings. I'll just give you a little context, or if you need a refresher. But basically, we're going to play this clip, and then we'll come back and talk about it. But so for those of you who don't know about Lord of the Rings, it's this fantasy novel. It's very fascinating because Tolkien makes this whole fantasy world. He actually invented languages. He actually invented them first, and then he like created the history behind the languages, and that's how this all ties in. You could get real deep into that. I'm not going to go into that today. But so basically, what's happening in the story is there's this, I guess you say, magical ring, and it has the power to like control world powers, and it used to belong to this Dark Lord, and you know, there's huge battle before the story, and he's defeated by his finger gets chopped off where the ring's on, and it falls off, and you know, his army's defeated, and the good guys, they take up the ring, but it kind of corrupts them, and eventually the ring is lost. And where this story comes in, it's been found again. And Gandalf kind of is the, I guess, the voice of wisdom, if you want to say, in this story. He's the wizard. And he's telling Frodo, who is the hobbit, and the men and the elves in the story. You know, there's all these different races of people in this story. And they're all coming together, at least the good ones are coming together. And they're going to say, we need to destroy this ring. We need to destroy it. It's where the Dark Lord gets his power from. And so we need to go. And the only place where we can go is by going into the Dark Lord's territory, into this volcano, and throwing it into the volcano and making it melt and be destroyed. So this chapter picks up about halfway through the first book, maybe even a little bit less than that. But basically, they're traveling on their way to
destroy this ring, and they have to go through this mountain. It's and the dwarves, who are one of the races of people in this story, they kind of have created these, you might call them, castles underneath the mountains. But in doing so, they unearth these almost like demonic forces that, they basically control this place now. And so they go into this big like castle underground. And so there's big caverns with caves, and it's really dark. And, so they're making their way through this, hoping to get through without encountering any evil things or things they're going to try to kill them or take the ring. And that's kind of where the story picks up. So that's kind of just setting the stage. Just imagine they're in this dark place. They're trying to sneak their way through, and where the reading picks up, that's where we're going to play it. So here we go.
There came a great noise, a rolling boom that seemed to come from the depths far below and to tremble in the stone at their feet. They sprang towards the door in alarm. Doom, doom, it rolled again, as if huge hands were turning the very caverns of Moria into a vast drum. Then there came an echoing blast. A great horn was blown in the hall, and answering horns and harsh cries were heard even further off. There was a hurrying sound of many feet. "They are coming," cried Legolas. "We cannot get out," said Gimli. "Trapped," cried Gandalf. "Why did I delay? Here we are caught, just as they were before. But I was not here then. We will see what..." Doom, doom, came the drum beat, and the walls shook. Heavy feet were heard in the corridor. Boromir flung himself against the door and heaved to it. Then he wedged it with a broken sword blades and splinters of wood. The company retreated to the other side of the chamber. But they had no chance to fly yet. There was a blow on the door that made it quiver, and then it began to grind slowly open, driving back the wedges. A huge arm and shoulder with dark skin and greenish scales was thrust through the widening gap. Then a great flat toeless foot was forced through below. There was dead silence outside. Boromir leaped forward and hewed at the arm with all his might, but his sword rang, glanced aside, and fell from his shaken hand. The blade was notched. Suddenly, to his own surprise, Frodo felt a hot wrath blaze up in his heart. "The Shire!" he cried, and springing beside Boromir, he stooped and stabbed with Sting at the hideous foot. There was a bellow, and the foot jerked back, nearly wrenching Sting from Frodo's arm. Black drops dripped from the blade and smoked on the floor. Boromir hurled himself against the door and slammed it again. "One for the Shire!" cried Aragorn. "The hobbit's bite is deep. You have a good blade, Frodo, son of Drogo." There was a crash on the door, followed by a crash after crash. Rams and hammers were beating against it. It cracked and staggered back, and the opening grew suddenly wide. Arrows came whistling in, but struck the northern wall and fell harmlessly to the floor. There was a horn blast and a rushing of feet, and orcs one after another leaped into the chamber. How many there were, the company could not count. The affray was sharp, but the orcs were dismayed by the fierceness of the defense. Legolas shot two through at the throat. Gimli hewed the legs from under another that had sprung on Balin's tomb. Boromir and Aragorn slew many. When 13 had fallen, the rest fled shrieking, leaving the defenders unharmed, except for Sam, who had a scratch along the scalp. A quick duck had saved him, and he felled his orc, a sturdy thrust with his barrow blade. A fire was smoldering in his brown eyes that would have made Ted Sandyman step backwards if he had seen it. "Now is the time," cried Gandalf. "Let us go before the troll returns." But even as they retreated and before Pippin and Merry had reached the stair outside, a huge orc chieftain, almost man-high, clad in black mail from head to foot, leaped into the chamber. Behind him, his followers clustered in the doorway. His broad, flat face was swart, his eyes were like coals, and his tongue was red. He wielded a great spear. With a thrust of his huge hide shield, he turned Boromir's sword and bore him backwards, throwing him to the ground. Diving under Aragorn's blow with the speed of the striking snake, he charged into the company and thrust with his spear straight at Frodo. The blow caught him on the right side, and Frodo was hurled against the wall and pinned. Sam, with a cry, hacked at the spear shaft and it broke. But even as the orc flung down the truncheon and swept out his scimitar, Andúril came down upon his helm. There was a flash like flame and the helm burst asunder. The orc fell with cloven head. His followers fled howling as Boromir and Aragorn sprang at them. Doom, doom went the drums in the deep. The great voice rolled out again. "Now!" shouted Gandalf. "Now is the last chance. Run for it!" Aragorn picked up Frodo where he lay by the wall and made for the stair, pushing Merry and Pippin in front of him. The others followed, but Gimli had to be dragged away by Legolas. In spite of the peril, he lingered by Balin's tomb, with his head bowed. Boromir hauled the eastern door to, grinding upon its hinges. It had great iron rings on either side, but could not be fastened. I am all right, gasped Frodo. I can walk. Put me down. Aragorn nearly dropped him in amazement. I thought you were dead, he cried. Not yet, said Gandalf, but there is time of wonder. Off you go, all of you, down the stairs. Wait a few minutes for me at the bottom, but if I do not come soon, go on. Go quickly and choose paths leading right and downwards. We cannot leave you to hold the door alone, said Aragorn. Do as I say, said Gandalf fiercely. Swords are no more use here. Go! The passage was lit by no shaft and was utterly dark. They groped their way down the long flight of steps and then looked back. But they could see nothing except high above them the faint glimmer of the wizard's staff. He seemed to be still standing on guard by the closed door. Frodo breathed heavily and leaned against Sam, who put his arms about him. They stood peering up the stairs into the darkness. Frodo thought he could hear the voice of Gandalf above, muttering words that ran down the sloping roof with a sighing echo. He could not catch what was said. The walls seemed to be trembling. Every now and again the drum beats throbbed and rolled doom-doom. Suddenly, at the top of the stair, there was a stab of white light. Then there was a dull rumble and heavy thud. The drum beats broke out wildly, doom-boom, doom-boom, and then stopped. Gandalf came flying down the steps and fell to the ground in the midst of the company. Well, well, that's over, said the wizard, struggling to his feet. I have done all that I could, but I have met my match and have nearly been destroyed. But don't stand here. Go on. You will have to do without light for a while. I am rather shaken. Go on. Go on. Where are you, Gimli? Come ahead with me. Keep close behind, all of you. Gimli took his arm and helped him down to a seat on the step. What happened away up there at the door? He asked. Did you meet the beater of the drums? I do not know, answered Gandalf, but I found myself suddenly faced by something that I have not met before. I could think of nothing to do but to try to put a shutting spell on the door. I know many, but to do things of that kind rightly requires time, and even then the door can be broken by strength. As I stood there, I could hear orc voices on the other side. At any moment, I thought they would burst it open. I could not hear what was said. They seemed to be talking in their own hideous language. All I caught was gosh, that is fire. Then something came into the chamber. I felt it through the door, and the orcs themselves were afraid and fell silent. It laid hold of the iron ring, and then it perceived me and my spell. What it was I could not guess, but I have never felt such a challenge. The counterspell was terrible. It nearly broke me. For an instant, the door left my control and began to open. I had to speak a word of command. That proved too great a strain. The door burst into pieces. Something dark as a cloud was blocking out all the light inside, and I was thrown backwards down the stairs. All the wall gave way, and the roof of the chamber as well, I think. Even as he spoke, they heard the pursuing drumbeat. Doom, doom, doom. Away beyond the shadows at the western end of the hall, there came cries and horn crawls. Doom, doom. The pillars seemed to tremble and the flames to quiver. Now for the last race, said Gandalf. If the sun is shining outside, we may still escape. After me! He turned left and sped across the smooth floor of the hall. The distance was greater than it had looked. As they ran, they heard the beat of an echo of many hurrying feet behind. A shrill yell went up. They had been seen. There was a ring and clash of steel. An arrow whistled over Frodo's head. Look ahead, cried Gandalf. The bridge is near. It is dangerous and narrow. Suddenly Frodo saw before him a black chasm. At the end of the hall, the floor vanished and fell to an unknown depth. The outer door could only be reached by a slender bridge of stone, without curb or rail, that spanned the chasm with one curving spring of 50 feet. It was an ancient defense of the dwarves against any enemy that might capture the first hall and the outer passages. They could only pass along in a single file. At the brink, Gandalf halted, and the others came up in a pack behind. Lead the way, Gimli, he said. Pippin and Merry next. Straight on and up the stair beyond the door. Arrows fell among them. One struck Frodo and sprang back. Another pierced Gandalf's hat and stuck there like a black feather. Frodo looked behind. Beyond the fire he saw swarming black figures. There seemed to be hundreds of orcs. They brandished spears and scimitars which shone red as blood in the firelight. Doom, doom, rolled the drum beats, growing louder and louder. Doom, doom. Legolas turned and set an arrow to the string, though it was a long shot for a small bow. He drew, but his hand fell, and the arrow slipped to the ground. He gave a cry of dismay and fear. Two great trolls appeared. They bore great slabs of stone and flung them down to serve as gangways over the fire. But it was not the trolls that filled the elf with terror. The ranks of the orcs had opened, and they crowded away as they themselves were afraid. Something was coming up behind them. What it was could not be seen. It was like a great shadow, in the middle of which was a dark form, of man shape maybe, yet greater, and a power and terror seemed to be in it and to go before it. It came to the edge of the fire and light faded as if a cloud had bent over it. Then, with a rush, it leaped across the fissure. The flames roared up to greet it and wreathed about it, and a black smoke swirled in the air. Its streaming mane kindled and blazed behind it. In its right hand was a blade like a stabbing tongue of fire, and in its left it held a whip of many thongs.
"Aye, aye," cried Legolas. "A Balrog! A Balrog has come!"
Gimli stared with wide eyes. "Durnsbane!" he cried, and letting his axe fall, he covered his face.
"A Balrog," muttered Gandalf. "Now I understand." He faltered and leaned heavily on the staff. "What an evil fortune, and I am already weary."
The dark figure, streaming with fire, raced towards them. The orcs yelled and poured over the stone gangways. Then Boromir raised his horn and blew. Loud the challenge rang and bellowed, like the shout of many throats under the cavernous roof. For a moment the orcs quailed and the fiery shadow halted. Then the echoes died, as suddenly as a flame was blown out by a dark wind, and the enemy advanced again.
"Over the bridge!" cried Gandalf, recalling his strength. "Fly! This is a foe beyond any of you! I must hold the narrow way! Fly!"
Aragorn and Boromir did not heed the command, but still held their ground, standing side by side, behind Gandalf at the far end of the bridge. The others halted just within the doorway at the hall's end and turned, unable to leave their leader to face the enemy alone. The Balrog reached the bridge. Gandalf stood in the middle of the span, leaning on the staff in his left hand, but in his other hand Glamdring gleamed, cold and white. His enemy halted again, facing him, and the shadow about it reached out like two vast wings. It raised the whip, and the thongs whined and cracked. Fire came from its nostrils, and Gandalf stood firm.
"You cannot pass," he said.
The orc stood still, and a dead silence fell. "I am the servant of the secret fire, wield of the flame of Arnor. You cannot pass. The dark fire will not avail you. Flame of Undun, go back to the shadow. You cannot pass."
The Balrog made no answer. Then the fire in it seemed to die, but the darkness grew. It stepped forward slowly onto the bridge, and suddenly it drew itself up to a great height, and its wings were spread from wall to wall. But still Gandalf could be seen glimmering in the gloom. He seemed small and altogether alone, gray and bent, like a wizened tree before the onset of a storm. From out of the shadow, a red sword leaped flaming. Glamdring glittered white in answer. There was a ringing clash and a stab of white fire. The Balrog fell back and his sword flew up in molten fragments. The wizard swayed on the bridge, stepping back at a pace, and then again stood still.
"You cannot pass," he said.
With a bound, the Balrog leaped full upon the bridge. Its whip whirled and hissed.
"He cannot stand alone," cried Aragorn suddenly, and ran back along the bridge. "Elendil," he shouted. "I am with you, Gandalf."
"Gondor," cried Boromir, and he leaped after him.
At that moment, Gandalf lifted his staff, and crying aloud, he smote the bridge before him. The staff broke asunder and fell from his hand. A blinding sheet of white flame sprang up. The bridge cracked. Right at the Balrog's feet it broke, and the stone upon which it stood crashed into the gulf, while the rest remained poised, quivering like a tongue of rock thrust out into emptiness. With a terrible cry, the Balrog fell forward, and its shadow plunged down and vanished. But even as it fell, it swung its whip, and the thongs lashed and curled about the wizard's knees, dragging him to the brink. He staggered and fell, grasped vainly at the stone, and slid into the abyss. "Fly, you fools," he cried, and was gone. The fires went out and blank darkness fell. The company stood, rooted with horror, staring into the pit. Even as Aragorn and Boromir came flying back, the rest of the bridge cracked and fell. With a cry, Aragorn roused them.
"Come, I will lead you now," he called.
"We must obey his last command. Follow me."
So we just listened to a very epic recording of our very own Brian Murphy, as I mentioned before, reading this passage that Brian was just setting the stage for. So, Brian, can you give us just kind of your initial thoughts about why you picked this one in particular, particularly as it relates to fortitude?
I picked this one because, well, I think there's a lot of examples in here of fortitude. You can kind of see the story. They're going through this dark and scary place, and there's, the drum beats start beating, and they realize that someone's coming after them. They're not even at the beginning. They're not really sure who it is, but you can kind of tell that all the characters are scared. They want to get out of there. They want to get along with it. So they're faced with this fearsome situation, this terrifying situation, especially as the As we get along in the chapter, and this huge Balrog shows up, this kind of demonic creature, And so I think there's just a lot of examples of here where they're faced with a fear, they're faced with making tough decisions of what should they do, how are they going to get out of this thing alive and make it and protect themselves. And yeah, so there's just a lot of examples here of where they have the ability to exercise fortitude.
My first thought, you know, coming at this from someone who's trying to see how I can meditate on this, how I can reflect on it and implement ways to become, you know, more courageous in my own life, is that it's actually a very novel take. You and I have talked about how, like, Hollywood and the media in general typically likes to portray fortitude in a very kind of like action sequence way. When we talk about fortitude in the media, I typically think about, say, war and something like Band of Brothers, where you have two competing armies facing off. Don't get me wrong, that takes a lot of courage. And it's a very fearful situation, particularly like in Band of Brothers, you have that one guy who even gets, I forget what they call it, I think it's like battle blindness because of just the stress and the anxiety of dropping into combat during D-Day. But in this scene, and during a lot of the Lord of the Rings, first of all, these guys are very much outnumbered. There's, what, 9 of them? 10 of them? And they're up against an entire horde. And Tolkien does a really great job of depicting that horde. He talks about the noise that you can hear. And you can really feel it. Like, I love the clip because you have the music going on in the background. And you can really kind of feel it in your bones. Like, these people are chasing after them. And that's the second aspect. Having that chase is not something that's really talked about or depicted in a lot of modern media. And by doing it, you know, in writing, and as we mentioned before, you have to kind of use your imagination here and put yourself in the shoes of the characters, you're able to get a much more kind of novel way of needing to practice fortitude. Because my face value reaction to this is that if I was in Gandalf's shoes or if I was one of the hobbits, I would probably freeze up just out of fear. If I was hearing all of these people that were trying to get me and kill me in probably very nasty ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those orcs are not nice people. They don't fight nice. They fight dirty, and you know, they might even torture you if they capture you. So it's not a situation that you want to be in.
Right. And one of the other things I like, you know, and we've talked about Brotherhood briefly before, and that's something we're definitely gonna be talking about coming up over the next couple of months. But there definitely is a lot of brotherhood, and these people, you can see the trust they have with each other. How not only are they trusting that, okay, Gandalf's going to be able to, you know, hold off this, but they're trusting each other in terms of leading the way in a very dark cave, as you were mentioning, Brian. And they're trusting the way in terms of supporting each other. Because if they don't have that tight-knit brotherhood, even though they've not been together that long, they're not going to make it. You know, if they all go and do their own individual things, or they all try to be the leaders in the scenario, they're going to die and they're going to fall apart before that. And it's going to be a very tragic situation. So having that need to be courageous, but also do it in a prudent way, so you're not being kind of like the rogue or the wild card and putting everyone else in harm's way, is actually the right way to view this scene.
Yeah, that's a good point about prudence, because I think when you think of courage, fortitude, the kind of stereotypical example from the movies is like, you know, someone's charging machine gun nest, like the example we like to use. But I mean, this whole chapter, they're running away. They're trying to get out of here. They're trying to escape. They're retreating. And you know, there's certain points where they have to stand and fight. But it's not as, I guess, sexy as maybe charging a machine gun nest. It's not the stereotypical example of fortitude.
Absolutely. And when you look at, like, one of the good lines for me, you think of Legolas. And if you look at the movies, you know, you have Orlando Bloom playing him. He's one of the, you know, like the quote-unquote sexy characters. He has everything going on for him. But when he sees the Balrog come, he basically wails and laments the fact that it's there. He's afraid, and you can very much see that. Contrasting that to Hollywood depiction of the man charging the machine gun nest, really without fear. that's a little bit more unrealistic. Yes, you know, you could realistically have some lessen fear if you're running on adrenaline and things like that. But if you're in a scenario that calls you to be courageous, fear is going to most likely be there. And it's moments like this where you can really sit back and say, okay, well, if Legolas, particularly if you consider the movie version of him, is going to be afraid of something, and you're imagining someone who's supposed to be, you know, big and strong and able to withstand all of these things, well, you're able to put yourself in the shoes of the person who's exhibiting more realistic emotions. And by doing so, you can more realistically adapt their responses to your own life and practice them like that.
Right. I think a great example, too, is, and maybe I should have explained this more in detail, is the hobbits, the way the hobbits respond. Because you think of the hobbits, they're like, what, 4 feet tall at the most? They're like small children. But the, you know, Frodo, you know, Boromir's barring the door at the beginning there, and Frodo's the one that comes in to help him. You know, he stabs the foot, not anything like super amazing, but, you know, it kind of describes him as like, he doesn't even realize what he's doing, but like this fire wells up in him and he realizes he needs to help his friend, and he comes to his rescue. And kind of the same thing with Sam later, you know, Sam, another hobbit, when Frodo stabbed with the big steer, like, big spear, Sam comes in and, you know, chops off the end and is like the first one there against this like huge enemy that he's facing. So you can just think of how scared these, you know, they're adults, but they're basically the size of children against like a foe that's like maybe a big man, if not bigger than that.
Heck, Tolkien even says that Gandalf, compared to the Balrog, looks small like a withered tree, which is interesting, you know, because then you consider Gandalf versus the hobbits, and Gandalf's, you know, probably twice their size. One of the things that I also find very interesting about this scene in particular is, you know, if I put myself in their shoes, if I was in a situation where I was surrounded, I would not really think that I had any hope of survival. Or any chance of survival. I would hope that I would survive, but my odds would be very slim. Particularly when you consider that, you know, it's very dark, as you mentioned. They don't exactly know where they're going, and because this is not some place they were there before, they don't really have any recollection of any of their surroundings. And if you're a really big Tolkien fan, and if you're just... if you're a really big, like, nerd or science fiction or fantasy fan in general, first of all, you may have read this a bunch of times, so you automatically know that these guys are going to survive. But if you also kind of know a lot of the tropes in science fiction or fantasy, you probably know that most of the main characters are going to make it through to the end, because they need to have that kind of resolution at the very end of a good narrative story. That is the Western narrative, the hero's journey that is so often imitated and has been since the time of Homer. But if you're actually putting yourself in these scenarios, which is what these books are really, really, really good for, you have to realize that you would probably die. That has to be a thought going through your head. Because, you know, another great example, and Brian, this gets to your point about the hobbits, these people are not trained swordsmen. Irregardless of the fact that they're 4 feet tall, or however tall they are, they're not like, you know, grizzled veterans of a war. So because of that, putting them in this situation would be like giving me a machine gun, sending me to Iran and saying, okay, hold off this enemy. It would be very fearful. I wouldn't exactly know what I'm doing. And there would be not just a lot of trial and error. I would probably die well before that. But if you put me in this situation too, I don't know really how to use a sword. I'm not a trained skilled swordsman. And putting me in a scenario where I am outnumbered by a ravaging horde that wants to kill me, that also greatly outnumbers me by probably a couple hundred to one. Well, I'll be honest, man, I'd shit my pants. But that's the beauty of it, because we are able to, by meditating and by really, you know, having this conversation that Brian, you and I are having with ourselves, we're able to kind of realize, okay, well, I know I'm going to be scared in a scenario like that. How do I move on? How, if the Balrog approaches me in real life, How do I face that? You know, and that's actually, like I mentioned before, that's the beauty of these stories, because I can do it from the safety of my comfy office chair.
Right. That's so true. And I think one of the other keys here is that they're not just fighting for themselves. Like, obviously they don't want to die. Like, they're going to try to protect themselves, but they're also fighting for their friends. And more importantly, they're fighting for, you know, everyone, that for the whole world, basically, because they got to destroy this ring. Otherwise, you know, everyone in the world is going to be enslaved. So they have, you know, they have their friends that they're fighting for, but they also have this just cause that they're fighting for. So they kind of, you know, they don't have the luxury of saying, like, oh, I'm going to die here. Like it doesn't matter if they die. They need to keep fighting for what they believe in.
You know, that's interesting, because as you were talking about that, I don't have a cause anywhere near as big as what they're trying to do. I don't have a Sauron in my life that I need to stop, or a ring that I need to destroy, God forbid. But, like, I'm just trying to think, like, let's say if my wife was in danger, if I needed to do something, otherwise something bad would happen to her. You know, I would be in that same scenario where you have that basically double motivation that they have of failure's not an option. And, you know, we could bring up something like Apollo 13 as well, which was basically that quote summed up, failure is not an option, because otherwise these men in this capsule in the middle of space die a very grisly and unfortunately kind of public death, since they still had the connections and such. So having that level of motivation is definitely great to spurring on courage. Now, what I will say is that you should not rely on that. You've all heard of this, you know, the mother lifting the car off of a newborn baby strength. Obviously, a mother cannot do that unless she's maybe like a, you know, gold medal Olympic weightlifter and deadlift or something like that. But that's one person. And so you always hear of these stories about adrenaline, and I'll say really anything that's going to motivate you to kind of go above and beyond your physical, mental, or emotional capabilities. But if you know, kind of sit through life, if you sit on your couch and then when duty calls and the Balrog appears at your door, expect to be able to fight it off, you know, or really even just have the courage to fight it off, you're not going to be able to do that. You're not going to be able to do that at all in the same manner that these, you know, hobbits and untrained sojourners are. So being prudent about it, and in this scenario, that really means having the foresight to train, both physically, like with a sword, but also to have your mental and emotional faculties, you know, sharpened so that you can be courageous, not just when you have that extra ounce of motivation, but even when you don't, and when that fades, that's what's really important, and that's what we're trying to get at here.
The one part of this story that I think it's one of the greatest parts of the book is when Gandalf, he stands there to protect his friends. He basically says that, you know, this foe is beyond any of you. You're not going to be able to fight and win this battle. But, you know, I have the power to at least protect you here. And so I'm going to stand on this bridge, and I'm not going to let this demon pass me, this Balrog pass me, so that I can protect my friends, and so that they, and he ultimately, he stands there, he defends them from the Balrog, and then he falls into the abyss, and for all they know, that they're never going to see him again.
I think that's a really powerful image too, because you know Gandalf knows that's what's going to happen. Like the way that Tolkien writes it, Gandalf is well aware that in order to stop this thing and in order to save his friends and have them continue on in this very important journey to really save the world, he's going to have to, in this moment, sacrifice himself in a certain way. I'll say, I won't give too much away, but he needs to sacrifice himself in order for the journey to continue on. And this is where, you know, Brian, you and I have talked about, when we were talking about courage before, about the idea of a hopeless cause and why courage isn't exactly fighting for a hopeless cause. And this is actually a great example where, you know, Gandalf is doing all of this for a cause that still has hope. He is being courageous. He is going above and beyond the call of duty, to quote that phrase, so that the mission can continue and so that the world can be saved. And while these are all very common fictional tropes, the way that it's written is amazing, because you get that insight into the character's mind.
Yeah, I think one of the keys to recognize here when we talk about, you know, facing your own Balrog or facing your own horde or whatever it is, like, I don't think we're going to face any Balrogs. I haven't seen any around lately, but, you know, we will face difficult challenges, maybe challenges that are terrify us, that seem hopeless, that seem like they can't be overcome. But so that the kind of the question is, what happens when we are faced with something like that? What should we do? And I think reading the story helps us to recognize, like, okay, maybe Gandalf, he fell into the abyss. He was lost to the company, and so, you know, for all intents and purposes, his cause was hopeless. But he was fighting for a greater cause, and so maybe we face these things, and maybe we fail, but we face them because we know that we're fighting for something that is more important than just the result of the specific act that we're doing.
You know, while you were talking right there, it made me think that on the shirts that you and I are going to get, and that any man that joins our Vital Masculinity Spartan Race team are going to get, we should add on the back, you know, conquering our personal Balrogs one day at a time.
I'll go for that.
Well, that'll be one of the possible suggestions. So if you have any more, definitely reach out to us or leave a comment below. But, you know, I love actually doing a lot of these things, because you and I started off this episode talking about how good fiction can be used to kind of spur on virtue and spur on these conversations with yourself and with other people, like you and I are having and are having with our audience. And yeah, bad fiction, you don't want to be doing that with. But I love doing this because it's very easy for me to just read Lord of the Rings and read it as a book that I can enjoy. And you know, at the end of the day, there's nothing wrong with that. As long as I'm not overdoing, you know, reading all of these fictional books and things like that, or trying to treat it as escapism, you know, it's a good hobby to have. Reading's good, especially books that are written very well and are considered classics, like pretty much anything Tolkien has. But it's always great to take that next step, to take these books that are good and enjoyable, and then to see how, you know, you can use it to become a more virtuous life. In our wrap-up for the cardinal virtues, I kind of talked about the filet mignons versus the Big Macs or the chicken nuggets, where one of them is going to be a lot better for your soul and for you, and it's going to be a lot more pleasurable, a lot more nutritious, and the other one's basically just fast food, and it's only designed to be cheap and pleasurable. Well, if you're consuming the filet mignon of books, which I would consider, like, you know, Tolkien in this case versus, I don't know, a dime store romantic novel or 50 Shades of Grey. I don't know any really cheap, crappy books that men would read anyway. So those are the first two things that came to mind. But, you know, if you're already consuming that great juicy filet mignon, why not add a couple of veggies and things like that by meditating on this? And man, I really got to stop with the food analogies, but at least that makes sense to me. Yeah. Maybe it's because I'm still trying to bulk up.
Let me just end with one point, and maybe this is something that you guys can meditate on in addition to everything we've talked about. But I love, you know, after Gandalf has fallen into the abyss, right before that, you kind of see Aragorn and Boromir come up. You know, they want to help Gandalf, even Gandalf, they want to come to his aid, you know, but, you know, he told them that this is a foe beyond them, but they still come to his aid. And then he falls into the abyss and they're all horrified, but Aragorn takes charge and he says, "Let's go on. We have to follow his last command. I'm going to lead you on." And, you know, that's what a real man of fortitude does.
He steps up, right? There was no hesitation. There was no, you know, bemoaning the fact that they lost their de facto leader of the expedition. And And that's a really great way to end it, man. I really hope all of you gentlemen meditate on that, because I know that I'm going to be doing that once we wrap this up. But we definitely appreciate you guys listening into this podcast. This was a little bit different than some of the ones we've previously done, mixing a little bit of culture with the pursuit of virtue and brotherhood as well, because these are great examples of brotherhood and men on a journey together. So if you want us to do more of these during our interludes and in between some of our series, definitely let us know, because we love to hear your feedback. And if this is something that is beneficial to you and just an enjoyable podcast, you know, give us some examples. We would definitely prefer older books, so we'd rather read and discuss scenes from War and Peace than, say, Harry Potter, because, well, there's a lot of reasons why, but I think you can probably think of a few yourself. You know, you can contact us by going to our website, and there's a link below to our contact form. You can also join our Facebook group, or apply to join our Facebook group. We are growing very fast in there still, which is always nice to see. And you can have a conversation about this podcast episode, as well as all of the other things we've talked about, and really anything related to masculinity, virtue, and, you know, the kind of the pursuit of character in general. As I've mentioned before, we are now on Twitter, so you can follow us at the VM Pod, and there is a link to that below, and we offer a lot of nice wisdom outside of just publishing our episodes. So if you're listening, we probably think you're going to enjoy what we're posting there as much as we can. Post wise things at 140 characters or whatever it is now. You know, I don't have anything else, Brian, so we'll just wrap it up. Thank you again for listening, gentlemen. And remember, virtue makes the man.